this is the Russophiles Unite podcast, where we watch Russian films and films with a Russian connection. As always, I am joined by a guest, and today I am joined by, let's be honest, quite a regular guest. My guest is Carrie. Hi, Carrie.
Hi, Ali.
So, Carrie, for those who haven't heard one of your previous appearances, could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
I'm Ali's hostage, who he gets when he can't convince a friend to watch a movie and have a conversation with him.
I thought you might do that.
Do what?
Say how you were under duress or something like that.
Ali won tickets to go see a movie in London, and so it's middle of the week, and he needed somebody to go with him. And when that happens, who do you get to go with you? Your wife.
I figured if I'd invited someone else first without asking you, you might have been a little bit offended, so I thought I'd give you first refusal.
Well, it would depend on who you'd be asking.
I don't know. I don't know who I'd be asking that you'd have a problem with.
I don't know either.
So, yes, as Carrie quite rightly says, I won some tickets to see a movie. It's being put on by Kino Classica, which is an organisation that promotes the screening of and organises the screening of Russian and Soviet films in the UK, primarily London. And this is part of the film we're watching today is part of their Youth on the March series, which by the time this goes out will be over. But apparently they're doing another season later on called Neverland, spelt N-E-V-A, so it's like based on St. Petersburg films. So anyway, enough free advertising for them.
The river Neva runs through St. Petersburg, by the way, for those that didn't know that.
Yes. Useful clarification there. Thank you, Carrie. Sorry, I'm doing the patronizing my guest thing again, which, you know, previous listeners will probably have learnt to recognize. I'm so sorry. I'm trying to learn to change my ways. Anyway, so, Carrie, the movie we're watching today, Asa, which is directed by Sergei Solovyov from 1987, had you heard about this film at all before I said, look, I got some tickets to go see this?
Nope.
All right. Well, that was a short conversation then. I don't know a ton about it either.
I just know that it was part of what Kino Classica was advertising as part of the Soviet New Wave. And they were really talking it up, saying it should be just as famous as the French New Wave, and people should know about it just as much. It seemed like most of the movies were depressing and had to deal with themes around all of the Soviet Union and what was going on at the time, and drugs and rock and roll and...
Yeah, yeah.
Stuff like that.
I think that's...
Youth. Yeah. And growing up and finding yourself when everything seems to be falling apart around you, sort of a...
Yeah, I mean, I think they did show some stuff that was from the 60s, so stuff was, you know, kind of working okay-ish as far as people could tell. But yeah, the ones they've done more recently have been, like, 80s.
Late 80s, or
Perestroika. Yeah, I didn't know a ton about this one either. Another podcast which... we've talked about a few times, Carrie. She's in Russia, did like a whole episode on Viktor Tsoi and like the Leningrad rock scene of the 80s. And I heard of Tsoi when I was living in Russia, and I kind of knew vaguely that he was a big deal, but I hadn't like searched his music out, and they played a few clips and it was really, really like right up my street.
So foreign and depressing.
Yeah. Did you notice how I just left a gap for you to insert joke about my music taste there?
Well, Ali has very specific music tastes. and he is not afraid to criticize anyone else's music that he considers to be cheesy.
Right, I will let people read between the lines there. Again, I am...
This is in no way, shape, or form a sore subject in our marriage. We also did our own music for our wedding, as in, like, you know, iPod DJ sort of a thing. So you can imagine, well, it was not for the wedding itself, for the reception and cocktail hour or whatnot. So you can imagine how many conversations we have had about this topic. I will leave it there.
Anyway, I think we should really start talking about the film that we're going to be watching again.
At the rate we're going, I'm probably not going in to watch the movie with you.
Okay, so anyway, that's something of an introduction to the film. I don't know whether there will be a part two to this episode at this rate.
But... tune in next time to find out if we do in fact make it into and out of London still married.
Funnily enough,
I get to pick the divorce music.
Oh man. Funnily enough, the last time we went into London to watch a movie, specifically a Russian movie, was the movie Loveless, which we also did on the podcast. And that's, by coincidence, out on DVD the day that we are recording this. So, who knows?
I'm mainly in it for the falafel.
Well, hopefully we'll be able to find some of that in the vast expanses of London.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So, thank you very much for listening so far. We're going to go away and watch the film, which... before we do so, we normally have a thing that we say.
Поехали.
Right, which means off we go. So, 3, 2, 1.
Поехали.
Поехали. У него был папа банана, и что теперь осталось только мама телефон, что скоро он уедет далеко. Так жить не в моготу, я подумал, ведь это нелегко. Сидеть и делать ту-ту-ту. Здравствуй, мальчик банана. And we're back. Carrie and I have just watched Asa. That's Asa, that's right. I was pronouncing it wrong in the intro, but never mind. Directed by Sergei Solovyov. And before we discuss what we thought of it, over to you, Carrie, for the summary. Not for the first time, I'm thinking, this is going to not be the easiest task. Which is why I'm letting you do it.
So the summary of Asa, it's a movie that takes a little while to get going. Main characters are Alika.
Mm-hmm.
Alika?
Yep. I forget where the stress is, but yeah.
Bananan and Artyom? Andrusha.
Andrei. His surname is Krimov.
Okay, Krimov. He has four or five different names. So Alika is a, we'll say, 20-year-old nurse.
Yeah, she looked very young. I mean, initially I thought, like, is she like 17 or 16? But she couldn't be, but she looks very young.
Well, it said she was working as a nurse at one point. Right. But so I'll say 20.
But would you agree that she looks perhaps younger than that?
She's very young. The actress herself could be a bit younger than that. Bananan is, my mom would call him artsy fartsy. He's kind of this out there lead singer in a band, doesn't have a real job, weird stuff hanging on the wall.
Technically, he does have a real job. But it's kind of like a, you can probably just show up to this, like, clock in, and that's fine, because officially you have to have a job, otherwise that's parasitism and you're in trouble. But yeah, you get the feeling he's not exactly pulling a 9 to 5:30, 9 to 6 deal, because mm-hmm. he has a lot of time on his hands. And yeah, I think it's fair to describe him as, shall we say, bohemian would yeah. be the kinder way of describing him.
Okay, bohemian. I think his job is the band plays in a hotel.
Yeah.
So, like, while people are eating or whatever.
Yeah, I thought he had, like, some kind of, like...
theater guard type gig, but you never see him actually doing it. Oh, that's right, no,
he's the harbour night watchman.
Okay.
I think they said that at the beginning.
But he never, like, does the job. No. Ever.
And nobody seems to really care that he's not doing it.
Yeah.
Hey, welcome to late Soviet work culture.
Yeah. Bananan is also, we'll say, early 20s.
Yeah, again, he looks super, super young. He's mm-hmm. very baby-faced.
But he's clearly, like, past school age.
Yeah.
But we'll say, you know, so Alika and Bananan, both early 20s. Alika's boyfriend is Krimov.
Yeah.
He's, what, 50?
Yeah, hard to place. Like, I'd say like 50 to mid 50s.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So, but 50.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Quite.
Krimov is and Alika being together, you know.
Yeah, there's it's an age difference. Not even like a May September relationship. It's a like early April
cradle robbing.
Yeah.
Jailbait type situation.
Oh yeah. Yes.
Which is especially appropriate considering as the movie goes on, you find out that Krimov is basically a mafia boss or a mob boss.
Yeah, I mean, you know from very early on he's shady.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can tell that he's rich, but there's just something about his not... Yeah,
well, it seems to be implied early on, because don't we meet him on board the ship?
Mm-hmm.
And that he's probably smuggling something or something along those lines.
Or trying to figure out how much he can smuggle.
Yeah, or how he would do that, yeah.
Yeah. But, like, it's not 100% clear what depth of it it's in, and it becomes yeah. more and more clear.
Yeah, or how nasty a guy he is, yeah.
Yeah, it's difficult to tell, is he just a corrupt businessman? Yeah. Is he just a corrupt businessman, or is it worse?
Or does he hurt people? Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Spoiler alert ahead. Yes. Sorry, should have put that in, but, you know, it's the plot summary, so...
So, Alika meets Bananan. Well, Alika has traveled to Yalta in Ukraine to meet up with Krimov.
Yes, yeah.
Because Krimov is sailing into Yalta on this big ship.
For those who are less familiar with the geography of that part of the world, it's in the Crimean Peninsula, so...
Yes.
And that's as much as we'll say on that.
Because Ali does not want angry emails
from
anyone. The UN, most countries in the UN recognize that as still being a part of Ukraine.
Yes, point of order is duly noted, and we shall continue with the summary.
Krimov is not in port yet because there's a storm, so the ship can't come into port. So she goes to the hotel and sees Bananan and his band playing, meets Bananan.
Yeah, it's kind of a gig / party. It's well attended.
Yeah, yeah, people are having fun, etc. So then Bananan says, hey, you can sleep at my boarding house. There's a spare room.
It's cheap,
etc. She does, and then next day she meets up with Krimov because he's able to pull into port. Krimov stays in a hotel, but he basically has this really nice, huge, like, apartment. It will be very nice today within this hotel. So you can tell he's got money.
Or connections.
Or both.
Yes, it turns out both, but anyway.
Yeah, so Krimov and Alika are dating, but... As the movie goes on, she spends more and more time with Bananan, and it's more like they're dating, and she's starting to fall in love with Bananan, and her relationship with Krimov starts falling apart. But, you know, a mafia boss is not going to be happy about some punk 20-year-old taking his girl.
And he's really, really not.
Yeah, so that's the setup for the tension and how those three main characters relate to one another. And in the background, you have Krimov is trying to plan and pull off a heist to steal stuff, and Bananan is playing songs with his band and recording and has some friends and that sort of thing's going on, and yeah, just kind of being whimsical and bourgeois, not bourgeois,
the opposite.
Bohemian, there yeah, we go, and trying to be as out there as possible.
Yeah, and, you know, wooing Alika as
yeah,
well. Yeah.
Oh, and the other mild undercurrent is that you have these cops, or I thought they were kind of a special elite unit of cop because they weren't wearing uniforms.
Yeah,
are plain, trying,
we'd call them plainclothes officers.
Yeah, well, investigators of some sort.
Yeah.
Because they aren't even plain clothes. Like, these are, they seem like they're top level or yeah, some sort of special, like I said, special investigative yeah, unit.
Which I guess in the context would mean they're like KGB guys, but they're not like just the regular, because like so many people are in the KGB. This is a kind of like,
it's never clearly stated at all.
No.
For
reasons that you can understand.
Yeah, so there are various, we'll call them police officers or investigators, for lack yeah, of a better term, who are trying to catch Krimov, and Krimov is trying to, and Krimov's associates, and the associates and Krimov himself are trying to stay
like
ahead of them.
At least, yeah. And also, Krimov is doing some light reading in his spare time.
Yeah, occasionally you'll see Krimov read a book, and the book is about Tsar Paul and his assassination. And
yes,
and what happens immediately, like some imaginary scenes before he's assassinated. So the movie will periodically cut back to, what would that be, early 1800s?
It's, yeah, yes, I think it's
1801, 1802?
Something in there, yeah, yeah.
Very early 1800s.
Yeah, I think there's 3, 4, maybe even 5 of these little interludes, and he literally, you know, he'll get to the end of the day, or he'll be in a car waiting for something, and he'll pick up the book, and then we're transported off to, you know, mm-hmm, Russian no, history.
And then we'll spend a few minutes back in Russian history, and then I'll go back to the present day.
Yeah.
So there's a, and Bananan has a couple dream sequences, so there's a lot going on in this movie. It's fairly difficult to sum up, but there's not a lot as far as plot. All the action happens within a few days.
I think so, yeah.
And the movie kind of gets darker and darker and more involved as it goes on.
Yeah, it's a long movie. It's not quite 2.5 hours, but I'd say 2 hours 20. In fact, that kind of contributed to us having a slightly interesting day when we watched this.
Yeah, and then when we got to the end of the movie, it's, I don't want to give away the ending and exactly what happens, but the movie ends in such a way that you want to watch the credits.
Yes.
Because there's kind of a concert and a song going on in the background. So as the credits start rolling, no one moved. Like, everyone in the theater stayed still to watch the whole credits until the very end. And Ali and I are sitting there going, we have to catch a train out of London. When's it gonna end? When's the train coming? Do we have enough time? So we had to get up and leave about 3 minutes before the credits finished.
Well, the credits were rolling, but they weren't done, and it wasn't just like, okay, the screen is black and it's a bunch of names, which, you know, it's respectful to stay to watch the credits, but many people
yeah,
don't.
It's like the credits were kind of rolling in such a way that it wasn't covering the whole screen, and they were kind of to the side of this concert playing and the song going. So we got about 3 minutes from the end, and we're like, we just have to go. So we did, in fact, leave, and it felt really disrespectful and awkward to get up and leave before ever, because we were really, like, the only ones who
yeah,
were getting up and leaving.
Yeah, which is rare.
It's very rare. Although it is good that we did, because
yes,
we ended up making the train just, like, if we had stayed to the end, we probably would have missed the train, and then we would have had to wait another hour in the station. And then while on the train, two very drunk guys sat behind us And one, I think, tried to offer me his hamburger from Burger King
Yeah.
by sticking it through
Between the
between the
two
seats.
seats.
And I
Yeah.
thought Allie was trying to touch my cheek, and except his hand doesn't smell like burger grease. And then
Not
the,
usually.
not usually, no.
There are occasions.
And then the guys trying to talk to me, and I had no idea what they were saying
Yeah.
at all.
I was barely able to decipher what they were saying.
So we, Allie and I, actually just looked for the credits and the final scene on YouTube so that we could watch and listen to the song to the very end to make
Yeah.
sure that we weren't
Yeah.
that nothing else happened and it
Yeah.
was quote unquote just the song.
So in a very technical sense, we had just finished watching, in brackets, the end of Asa. And of course, not being able to talk about the movie the whole way home has been kind of difficult. So I have no idea what you actually think of this.
Well, one thing I'd like to say is that it was actually turns out to be really good that I started the intro by talking about music and the problems we have with your taste in music and mine being very different. Because there was quite a lot of music within this movie. It was practically a musical with how often there were songs playing and whatnot.
Yeah, but not just songs. A lot of the time there was incidental music, and some of it was totally like weird sort of non-music, really. Basically, like scratching on guitar strings and kind of like playing notes on strings whilst detuning them. Like for the scene where the cops interrogate one of Krimov's crew. He's being interrogated and breaking down, and there's just this weird, like, atonal, bizarro music going on behind him. But yeah. But you were saying something about the music.
Yeah, you see, like Bananan's band plays a lot, and some of what he it plays is, for example, disrespectful or ironic about what's going on in the scene. Like, there's
Yeah.
one scene where a it's one of Cremo's crew, but he's wearing a military
It's
uniform,
an Air Force
Air
uniform.
Force uniform. That's right,
It's very
and.
important, though, that it's Air Force.
Yeah, because he pays Bananan and his band to play a song that praises the Air Force so you can ask a girl to dance and feel like really cool.
Особого внимания ВВС. Универсальная машина. Универсальная машина.
And Bon technically does what he's supposed to be doing, but it doesn't really, like the song, you don't get the feeling that it's like.
Particularly sincere, no.
No, it's definitely more ironic than anything else.
Yeah, well, he's also like wearing a sort of World War I-ish like flying
Cap and
cap and
goggles.
goggles, which is weird because the impression you get is that they're having to improvise this song because he's just requested it, yet somehow he just happens to have like this
The costume
Biggles.
change.
Yeah, so either they just happen to coincidentally have this gear lying around, which, you know, given the other stuff we find out about Bananan, that's not something I would totally put past him just having one of those to hand, but anyway.
Yeah. But what I wanted to ask you was, did you actually like the music? 'Cause I know the songs.
Yeah, they were. The music was really interesting. I mean, like you were saying, a lot of them are kind of jokey and ironic, but they kind of alternated between, like, in terms of the songs, they were mostly like fun, but some of like the incidental music that was melodic was really good. I think Boris Grebenshikov, who's like the lead singer, I'll probably get this wrong. I want to say it's Aquarium. I nearly said it was Leningrad, but it wasn't. It's Aquarium. Did a lot of the soundtrack, and there's some sitars on there. It's I really liked it.
Wow. Music that Allie liked.
Yeah. I'm not as perhaps as picky as I used to be, / and or, as Carrie makes out. I think I've mellowed, but What did you think of it, hon?
I thought it was good. I mean, the scene at the end, you have Victor Tsoi is singing. He was a famous Soviet rocker.
Yeah. I think we discussed him a bit in the beginning, but he's kind of in that, like, rock and roll age of death. I think he was like 27 or 28 when he died.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so he kind of has that sort of Jimi Hendrix, Kurt Cobain kind of...
Or if we're going to go with Russia, Pushkin.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
Or
status.
Oh, the other guy. Oh, Lermontov.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, Russian poets.
Yes.
So there is a bit of that going on.
Oh, another thing while we're on the subject of music. This is kind of a tangent into other stuff that I wanted to talk about. I noticed a couple of allusions to possible allusions. I think there were allusions to other Russian films in this one. One of which was there in a couple of scenes, there were strains of this piece by Bach. And I only knew that it was a piece by Bach because it's in the intro of Andrei Tarkovsky's Solaris, except on this it's played on quite weird instruments. I mean, it's a slightly weird version in the Tarkovsky film, but it's almost like, I think if I didn't recognise it from that film...
Because I didn't recognise it as being Bach at all.
No, but that's because it's very fragmented, but I recognise the melody, and it's kind of in the background. It was the scene where he's with... Important detail. Krimov is with his two friends / like colleagues who...
The ones that are the actors?
Yes, yeah. Who are of the smaller person variety. I'm not quite sure what the most respect...
Is it little people?
Yeah, yeah. I know what it definitely isn't. And I know sometimes people feel like little people or small people is patronizing, which, you know, I can see how you'd feel that way. But yes.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, he's shooting a video with them on some kind of grainy footage, and they're in the snow. And then we have these little strains of this Bach piece in the background.
Добрый день, дорогие телезрители. Мы ведем свой репортаж из Никитского ботанического сада. Сейчас наш сад выглядит необычно. Все субтропические растения покрыты большим слоем снега. Смотрятся такие теплолюбивые растения, как опунцы, бамбуки и некоторые виды чистого.
And the other, like, allusion I think I noticed was not quite at the beginning, but very early on, you see Alika standing in the harbour, and you just have these crashing waves, and in Battleship Potemkin they do that. So,
okay,
massive tangent ahoy. Sorry.
Yeah. No. The other thing about the movie that got me and kind of made it difficult to watch was Bananan's friend Vitya.
Yeah, Vitya
is in blackface.
Yeah, and he in the credits he is, I'm gonna loosely translate it as Vitya the black guy. And yeah.
Yeah. It's not blackface like Hollywood did it in the 30s and 40s. It's where it's clearly like charcoal black and jokey.
And hey, look, aren't black people hilarious?
No, it's definitely trying to seriously make him look black. It's just in the beginning, there's this one conversation where they're like, no, he's a real black guy in the Soviet Union. Isn't he a black guy? And they're going on and on about how much he's a black guy. And it makes you think, yeah, they protest too much.
Yeah.
It's like, wow, you couldn't find a single Russian-speaking black guy.
Yeah. Well, and they kind of make a point that, you know, we have... Maybe they don't make a point, but certainly, like, if you've lived in Russia for any time at all, you'll know that lots of students from various African countries go over there to study, and this has gone back to Soviet times, because it was kind of like, get a good education, and we get to teach to become a good Marxist, so everyone wins! So yeah, that being a big made such a big deal of is kind of weird, because it's kind of like, yeah, well, we know about this.
Well, it could be, there are themes throughout it about the government doing one thing and saying another, and not really meaning what it means, and kind of taking the piss out of the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
So this could be yet another way, because it mentions that in the movie, his dad is supposedly an Angolan freedom fighter who was tortured to death, and his mom's Russian.
Yeah.
So I think tortured to death by somebody within Angola, not tortured to death by the Soviets.
No.
just wanted to get that clear and out there. But it would just... Every time he was in a scene, all I could think was, they have an actor in blackface.
Yeah.
And I know that Hollywood and the States aren't innocent of the whole thing, but it's just, it took me out of it every time he was on the screen.
And, you know, the actor is doing...
Yeah, he's doing fine as an actor.
Yeah, and he's portrayed as a positive character. So, on the one hand, it's nice that they've got a black character, and that he's portrayed as being, like, just as capable and brave and interesting as all the white characters. It's just, as you say, kind of a shame they couldn't find a black actor who could speak Russian to do it.
Yeah.
But, like you're saying, Hollywood's not blameless, and this film came out only 3 years after 16 Candles, which has that hideous portrayal of Vietnamese...
I thought it was Japanese exchange student, but it doesn't...
No, he's Vietnamese, because he's called Long Duk Dong.
It doesn't really matter. It's a horribly, horribly offensive portrayal of a foreign exchange student from Eastern Asia who doesn't speak English well, and it's awful.
Hey, at least they cast an East Asian actor in the role.
Yeah, as opposed to having somebody in yellow face.
Yeah, although, just to clear up any ambiguity, I think that film is way more racist for doing that than this is.
Yes.
It's super not cool that it's blackface, but at least they're not like, hey, look, these people who are a different race to us, they're really stupid, aren't they? Ha 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 ha.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, John Hughes, you made some good films, but you sucked in that regard.
Yes.
Right. So now we've got the awkward racial element to the film kind of talked about. How did you like the other performances?
I mean, I think I liked Krimov the best out of all the other performances. It was kind of a quiet, slow-burning menace that didn't really fully come in until half to two-thirds of the way through the movie is when you really started to feel how bad of a guy he was.
Yeah, because he's, like you say, it's quite a nuanced, you know, he builds it up. And, yeah, when the nastiness comes, you're like, oh, right. And he's not just a thug, though, as well. He's portrayed as quite cultured. Like, we see him reading this book. Apparently he quotes some Pushkin at some point. You know, so it's not like a... Of course I'm not saying, like, you can't be a criminal and cultured, but...
And he plays tennis, and at first all you see him... The only thing you see him do that's quote-unquote bad is the whole, well, how much can I fit in here to smuggle sort of a thing.
Yeah.
But you don't really see any, like, he's not getting interrupted from dinner to go beat a guy up or anything until slowly it's like, he says to one character, oh, hide this for me, and it turns out to be a gun.
Yeah.
Yeah, and while planning the heist, and he's like, this is how you're going to steal this expensive violin for me. And it's like, the guy who has to steal it doesn't really have much of a choice. It's like, this is how it's going to happen. And
yeah. Well, and then he shuts the guy in the violin case, like...
Double bass case.
Yes, sorry. yeah, he's not that small. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and which must be quite upsetting, but he does it in kind of like a slow... It's not like he grabs him and like shoves him in the case and like shuts him in and goes, until you promise to do the job, I'm not going to let you out. But it is kind of like he briefly shuts him in there and then he unlocks it. And then when he opens it up, the guy's crying.
Well, the reason why this is one of his quote-unquote friends who's one of the actors and a little person, so that's how he's able to fit in this double bass case. Right,
and why he's probably wanted for this particular job?
Why he'd be able to do this particular job in this particular way. But the thing is, the actor is in quite a bit of debt, and that's why he's quote-unquote willing...
Yeah.
To do this for Krumov, yeah. Because he can't pay back the debt. But the thing is, before the actor talks to Krumov about his debt and says, look, I need help paying it off, Krumov has a conversation about needing the double bass case.
Mm.
So you kind of wonder if this old debt or something like Krumov knows about it and is purposely calling it in order to force this guy to help him with the heist.
Yeah.
Because yeah, at first he's like calling somebody and saying, I need a double bass case. And I'm like, why on earth?
Yeah. Yeah.
And then it only comes out later.
Yeah. I mean, if it is spelled out, I may have missed this in the subtitles.
I don't think it was spelled out at all. It was only thinking about it on the train on the way home that I'm like, wait a minute, that order... It's not like... And the actor said, hey, I need help with this debt. And then they got the double bass case. And then the plans started coming together for the heist. No, it's like the plans for the heist were put into play. And then the actor talks to him about the debt. And it's like, no, Krumov started everything from the beginning. And that's why it's like a menace slowly building. Because he's having this nice, pleasant conversation in front of everyone. And then you're like, oh, this wasn't a pleasant thing. This was...
like, subtly bullying people. Because the thing, yeah, he's civil in the vast majority of his interactions, especially early on.
You don't even hear him swear.
Hmm.
Like, there are a few swear words, especially towards the end, but really not at all. As far as the conversation goes, most of it's just, it's PG.
Yeah. I mean, part of that, I guess, was... I mean, obviously, the censorship at this point was easing right up. But there is some swearing, as you say, and, like, a few years before that, that wouldn't have been allowed at all, so...
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, he's not your, like, cardboard cutout, here's a mob boss.
Mm-hmm. And you don't have anything, in the Godfather, where you can't see the guy's eyes...
Yeah.
They're all in shadow.
Yeah,
and it gives him this really sinister look. Like, you don't have that obvious sinister...
Yeah.
There's nothing quite vibe. Like that vibe about him.
Yeah. Not wanting to knock Marlon Brando's performance in The Godfather, but he's very much playing a very obviously sinister guy from minute one.
Mm-hmm. But the lighting and the costuming and everything else... goes into that and makes it seem more and more like that, where I think Krumov is supposed to be not obviously awful
right
from the beginning.
And that's part of how he's managed to kind of elude the authorities, because he's not totally just blend into a crowd like meek and mild. He's quite a confident, you know, he carries himself with a lot of authority, but he doesn't kind of come across as like,
I don't know, I think he gets away with a lot because he pays off the cops. Because there's one scene where Krumov and Bananan are standing on the street, And Bananon's wearing an earring. And you do not wear earrings as a man in the Soviet Union. And Krimov, and the cop comes up to Bananon and is like, take that off.
Yeah.
Essentially. And Krimov says, he's with me. And then the cop apologizes and runs away.
Yeah. And I think that was just after Bananon has, like, literally spent a day in the police cells for wearing an earring.
Yeah. And he gets beaten up in the cell for wearing an earring.
Yeah.
And refusing to take it off.
Yeah. We should point out, it isn't just any old earring either. It's kind of a side detail, and we'll probably come back to this, but
it's an earring that has a... what are those photo booths? Called photo booths?
Well, it's just a photo booth, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, Alika and Bananon went into a photo booth and took pictures of themselves in this photo booth. And then he cuts a picture, one of those pictures off, and sticks it on an earring.
Yeah.
Or makes an earring of it and wears it around.
Yeah. And the really cute and funny thing about that is whenever it's raining or he's going anywhere where he might get wet, he has this plastic bag that he just puts around his ear and the earring so that it doesn't get damaged. Which,
yeah,
just, you know, is quite cute but does draw even more attention to it than, you know, having a photo booth picture stuck to your ear does anyway.
Yeah.
And, yeah, in terms of, yeah, going back to Krimov and his relationship with Alika, how did you find the way that was played?
I mean, there were, at first, it looks like it's kind of completely consensual and they're happy to be together and isn't this wonderful? And apparently, like, you find out that they've been together for 3 years and he's called her every day while they've been apart and all this stuff. And the only part that kind of rubs you the wrong way is he's obviously old enough to be her father. The controlling stuff is not immediately visible. It only starts to come out later.
Yeah, it kind of seems like that she's there because, you know, however misguided it is, she wants to be.
Mm-hmm. And she really loves him and cares about him.
And I think you get the impression she does care about him.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's part of what the tension in the plot becomes. Like, as she's falling in love with Bananon, she gets conflicted between Krimov versus Bananon.
Yeah.
And what Krimov is like versus what Bananon is like, and the different lifestyles and the different types of people that they are. The problem is with Krimov, you know, he's a mafia boss. He's not going to allow his girlfriend to leave him for some little punk.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so from this point, to discuss it properly, I potentially have to give away the ending. So super, 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 super spoiler alert. But Krimov doesn't go straight to the ultimate resolution of the problem that he goes to. That isn't his first
go-to. Yeah, it's a bit go-to. Cat and mouse.
Yeah.
Playing with your prey before you kill him off.
I didn't read it that way. I read it as he's just he's trying to get rid of him without having to get rid of him. And it just doesn't work.
But the going swimming thing.
Yeah, but he could totally have killed him then if he'd wanted to.
They go swimming in the Black Sea in winter.
Yeah.
So it's cold. Crazy cold. And I don't know how they didn't both get hypothermia. Because Bananon clearly has hypothermia afterwards.
Yeah.
But Krimov is like, okay. Like, I guess because Bananon is absolutely stick thin. Whereas Krimov, not that he's stick thin, he's in decent shape, but he's got a bit more muscle and stuff on him.
Yeah, he's kind of like middle-aged man who's done a pretty good job of looking after himself. He's not, like, super lean, but he doesn't have a paunch, really.
No. But yeah, at one point when they're far out and you can't see shore at all, and then they swim even further, and then Krimov kind of holds his head under Bananon's head underwater a bit before he lets him swim back to shore.
Yeah.
And I thought that was Krimov trying to subtly say, look, kid, I can off you at any point.
Right, but that's what I mean. He's trying to intimidate him to just, like, to, you know, make himself scarce rather than just, like, fine, I'm just going to murder you straight off.
Mm-hmm. But Bananan, for some reason, thinks, oh, yeah, I can totally stand up to a mafia boss.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. That's before the horse race, though, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, and it's not quite a horse race. It's like a buggy race, something
chariot
like that.
Chariot race? It's not chariots.
Yeah. Ben-Hur.
Ben-Hur. They have a Ben-Hur sequence.
I was surprised at this, because I didn't realise that there was kind of, like, organised gambling in the Soviet Union. That seems like something that Lenin would have been uncool about.
Yeah. There are horse races, and they have those little, they're not chariots, but they're not carts or whatever. Like,
yeah.
Racing carts.
Yeah.
With the horse race, and they put bets on it. And Krimov tells Bananan exactly how to bet and exactly how to win. And he wins, like, nearly 4,000 rubles or, like, some amazing amount of money for the time.
Coincidentally, just enough money to, or at least enough money, to pick up your whole life and move somewhere far away, which, hey, in the Soviet Union, quite a lot of places are really far away. So.
Well, no, he only asks him to move for 2 weeks.
Oh, okay, I missed that.
Yeah, he doesn't even ask him to move away permanently. He basically says, okay, go on a 2-week vacation, and when you get back, we'll be gone.
Okay, yeah. I thought he was... I totally misread that then, because I thought it was basically saying, look, go and settle somewhere else.
No. Was telling him to get lost.
Sure, yeah.
But it wasn't even, like, completely uproot your life and never come back. It was, you know, just give me 2 weeks.
Okay. I misread that then.
And Bananan refuses.
Yeah.
Despite this show of, look, I can control... how this horse exactly who's going to come in first, second, and third within this race.
Yeah, and he spells it out. He says something along the lines of, I'm someone who can make things happen.
Mm-hmm.
And this is pretty much as clearly as you can demonstrate something like that.
Mm-hmm. If you can fix a race perfectly for who is going to come into what place.
Yeah. And also, in terms of, like, him being reluctant to just off somebody... we were talking about the police investigators catching up with him. At one point, he's being followed through, not quite some back streets, but it's kind of a windy bit of town. Quite picturesque.
Mm-hmm.
And he basically catches the guy who's following him, and he roughs him up, but he doesn't kill him, and he totally could. He totally had the opportunity. And also his henchmen could have killed the guy.
Well, that's because the guy says, I don't want to work for... I think this is one of the investigators. It's one of the investigators.
Oh, it is, yeah.
But he says, oh, I don't want to work for the people I'm working for anymore. I want to work for you.
Yeah.
Is essentially the vibe I got. And
he does.
And Krimov basically says, okay, I'll have to make a couple calls to check you out.
Yeah.
In the meantime, be at this place at this time. So it's... I would think as a mafia boss, that's even smarter as far as being able to potentially send investigators a message, or being able to mess with them in some way.
Yeah, and I'm also guessing as a mafia boss, you probably think a lot harder about offing a member of the security investigative services than, like, a random... kid,
because
that's going to have much more serious repercussions. They're going to be much more committed to, you know, finding you and making your life very difficult. So that's probably, you know, it's not just out of the kindness of his heart, but he's quite a calculating guy. He's not just a, like, shooting everyone up type mafia boss.
No, he is not.
We're making this sound incredibly bleak and depressing, which is part of it, but I thought it was quite funny. You?
I did not laugh nearly as often as people in the theater did.
Mm.
Like, there was a lot of laughter in the theater at various parts, but I just didn't find it funny.
Okay.
I mean, you laughed along with everyone else, but I'm just kind of like, yeah. I mean, there were parts that were light and amusing, and lighthearted, and like with Alika and Bananam when they were on some of their dates, they were very, you know, yeah, like I said, lighthearted and youthful and young love sort of a vibe. But it just, I didn't think it was funny.
Okay, because I found quite a lot of it funny in a, not like that was a hilarious joke, which is partly, you know, just Russian is not my native language, and I haven't reached that level where, you know, I can pick up a clever pun particularly. But it was more like the humour of something weird or awkward happening, or just whimsical.
Well, you're English, of course you like the humour of something awkward.
fair enough. I've tried to make Carrie watch more than one Fawlty Towers episode in a row, and
that has not gone well.
No. It's like you can handle about one and then you get like a cringe overdose.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I thought it was funny in a weird way. And just some of like Bananan's creations are quite funny. Like, I liked the communication tube, which he says in English, which is basically like this just bit of piping that you put your mouth to and you get the other person to put their ear to the other end when you want to tell them something like important or intimate, which mm-hmm. just, I don't know why that's funny, but I thought that it was.
But it is kind of odd that it's the whole irony doing the opposite sort of thing, that you'd want to tell somebody something important or intimate, and I want to be intimate with you in some way, and therefore I'm going to put this thing between us,
this
and put this artificial,
massive, stupid bit of piping, yeah,
it's barrier. Really
unwieldy. That's probably why it's funny, yeah. I didn't think this was funny, but it was kind of cute.
Well, to go back to the communication tube, then Bananan gives it to Alika. And she goes to talk with Krimov in it. She's like, you first, and you tell me something. And you see him tell her something like, it's our third anniversary, let's have a party, who do you want to invite? But you never see her tell him anything.
Hmm. Huh. Yeah, I guess not. Interesting.
So that's a bit of the dynamic of their relationship. He's in charge.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Subtly. But he's in charge. It's,
yeah.
I want to celebrate this, so let's have a celebration. And yeah, sure, it's sweet. Let's celebrate our anniversary. But yeah. This is what I want to do to celebrate our anniversary in this way, and this is how we will do it.
Yeah. You do see a bit of violence in physical violence rather than like psychological or emotional violence in the relationship between the two of them.
Very, very end.
Yeah. The way I read it was that was either like the first time he'd actually hit her, or
yeah, I thought it was the very first time as well.
Yeah. Okay. I'm glad that wasn't me just being totally off about that. I mean, it's difficult to know, but
he hits her because she pours cologne into his eyes,
right?
And then he reacts in pain by hitting her, and then she hits him.
Yeah.
So there's some unhealthy behaviors going both ways.
Sure. I'm trying to remember exactly why she pours the cologne into his eye. I think it's some,
she just gets frustrated. He says, I have a headache. Rub cologne on my temples. So it's not even, can you please? It's, I have a headache, do this thing to make me feel better. So yeah. She starts rubbing the cologne on his temples, and then she just decides to pour it on his eyes. Yeah. And because cologne has quite a bit of alcohol in it, that would sting.
Yeah.
A lot.
Yeah, yeah. I never want that to happen to me, ever. and I think it's also soon after the swimming in the cold harbour incident, and he's kind of like,
yes,
said, oh, he'll be fine. And mm-hmm. you can tell, or at least I thought, you know, she wants to go to him, but she obviously doesn't feel like she can. But that seemed to be, like, the way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's very upset at Krimov for taking him for a swim in the middle of winter.
Yeah, understandably.
Anyway, the other whimsical moment that you wanted to talk about before I further it, put my input on the communication tube.
Yes. No, it was the... I play, like, a record on a record player, but he's modified it, so it has, like... I'm not sure what it's made out of. It seems like metal or shiny plastic. Like, palm tree. So it's spinning as the record turns. And then he drops something, which I think must have been, like...
baking soda.
Oh, okay. I thought it might be that, or it might be soap flakes.
Pishabai soda.
Ah, okay. Yeah, missed that.
It was baking soda.
Yeah. Carrie's Russian is considerably better than mine.
I also did most of the grocery shopping as far as, like, making the lists and whatnot.
True.
So...
true. In terms of keeping the record straight, for a long time when you were working an office 9-to-6 job in Moscow City and I was still an English language teacher, I was doing the grunt work of the weekly shop, so...
Yes, he was. But, like, I would actually create the list, so it was more like me needing to know, oh, I'm planning on baking something, you know, baking sodas, this, and then I would write it down. Now yeah. I just had to, was a bit more passive of just,
yes,
this is
yeah.
what matches that.
Yes, it's fair to say that...
And sometimes for things like baking soda, I would write it in English next to it, what it was.
Yeah, for a while, when we were getting used to the subtle linguistic differences between... the British and American variations of English, we would sometimes just use the Russian word because we both knew what we were talking about. Like,
yeah, kinza.
Oh, yeah, kinza.
So that's cilantro for Americans, coriander for Brits.
Yes. Kabachok, which is...
zucchini.
Slash... I can't even remember the English word now. Courgette. There we go. English. British English.
And we have genuinely had an argument about a mix-up with cilantro coriander.
Yeah, yeah.
So using the Russian did help. But anyway, yes. Tangent off of our marriage and back into
yes.
Pishivaya soda,
yeah.
the tree, and sprinkling the baking soda onto the tree.
Onto the palm tree, specifically. It's a palm tree.
There
and
we
that's
go.
It's like... oh, look, it's snow falling on a palm tree, which, you know, can only happen in Crimea. Because in summer, it's really, really warm.
Because it's on the Black Sea. It's like Turkey or Greece. Like,
yeah.
It's that kind of
yeah.
climate.
One of the final few things I want to talk about in the film is just, what did you think of the cinematography and direction and, like, you know, the way the camera moved and stuff? Do you have any strong feelings on that?
I thought there were some interesting shots as far as the way conversations were done when Krumov was talking, because it was often filmed with a camera in a different room from Krumov, and he was often walking away from the camera. You somehow couldn't see his face or was on the side when he was talking to anyone.
Hmm.
Not anyone, but it's just, it was often indirect, not quite... like, he wasn't facing the camera. It was a bit of the whole, he's slightly shady, he's not quite being straight with us as viewers, or people that he's talking to, or with what's going on around him.
I don't know whether this is a variation of the same thing, but it's certainly similar. I noticed a tendency when conversations were being shot that it would... look at the people having the conversation for a while, and then there'd be someone, like, incidental, like a waiter or someone would come in, and then instead of continuing to focus on the main people in the conversation, it would, like, follow the waiter or whoever's walking away from the table, but you'd still hear the conversation going on, which was kind of weird, but it did it a few times to the point where I thought, that's a deliberate... something. I'm not sure why it's doing that or what we're supposed to read into it, but it's a, you know, we're doing this on purpose.
Yeah, he very rarely did the thing where, like, two characters are having a conversation and you do a mid to close up shot of the one character talking, then mid to close up shot of the other, then mid to close up. Like, you don't have a conversation where it's cutting back and forth between them.
Yeah.
He'll film both of them talking to one another, and the camera's far enough away to see both of them.
Another thing they did is they did quite a lot of...
Or all three of them, or however many are in the conversation.
Yeah.
But anyway, sorry.
I don't know whether it would have been handheld, but... Because, you know, the equipment back then. But certainly following people around corridors in quite a sort of shaky, like... Not quite documentary, but...
I thought that was a deliberate choice.
Oh, sure, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. But it was repeated, and they did it quite a lot.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And again, not quite sure what I thought it meant, but...
Well, it might have been a bit more of the everything's slightly off-kilter, nothing's quite what it's supposed to seem to be. You have shots of people, you know, you have some people, characters who are actors, you have people who are setting things up and doing things behind the scenes and doing shady deals. Like, everything's not exactly what it is, except with Bananan. He is what he is the whole way. He's weird. He's off the wall. He combines all kinds of things where it's like, that shouldn't go with that, but he is who he is until the end.
And a lot of it kind of works in a funny way.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some beautiful scenery shots. There's one bit where Alika and Bananan take a cable car, which I don't know whether it's... I think it's sunset or approaching sunset.
This cable car would not pass health and safety inspections in the UK.
No, I would not get on this thing. So it looked super not safe, but it did look very pretty, like kind of going over the roofs and just seeing the city. I hadn't kind of realised the topography of that bit of Crimea as well. It seems like the town that they're in is built on quite a steep hill, so you get some quite dramatic shots of overlooking bits of the city.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the concert footage at the end is really cool as well.
Yes.
/ cheesy in some ways.
Yes, everyone has lighters.
Yeah, but it kind of works. I really like the...
You liking something that's cheesy?
Yes, I know.
What?
I know. For shame. Actually, going back to the humour, I think that's one of the funnier bits is when Victor Tsoi, is basically replacing Bananan as the band leader, and he's applying for the job. And under normal circumstances, you have to be a member of the musicians' union and be, like... an accredited musician to do...
Have graduated from a music college sort of a deal.
In order to get the job. And the very bureaucratic hotel staff member is kind of like, do you have all of these things? And Tsoi is very, like, rock and roll, like, no. And she goes, well, it just so happens that we're really struggling to find somebody, so... I guess we'll have to just overlook it. And then she starts to reel off this massive, massive long list of kind of contractual obligations and behaviours that he's supposed to be complying to and when he has to show up and all this. And he just gets up and walks off. And
that was funny.
It's really rude, but I understand why he did that. And then he just goes... and joins the band in the performance area of the hotel, and you see them playing, and then the camera flips around from them in the hotel to this massive crowd with lighters. It looks cool, and it flips back, and they're clearly, you know, playing a stage in a massive stadium, and that's the end credits. And that's the song's Perimien, which is a really famous Kino song. And, I mean, it's partly really famous because it's in this movie, which loads of people really liked.
Mm-hmm. It would be interesting, you know, to look up the words to Perimien, because that, like, a lot of the themes in that song seem to be some of the themes of what people are asking for or wanting in the movie.
It's basically the main chorus is, I want change, and then it switches to like we're waiting for change, or you could translate as we're expecting change, because like the Russian word for wait, I always feel has more of an aspect of or connotation of we're expecting something than just wait.
Bit more anticipation to it.
Yeah. Like you can say, the literal translation is I'm very waiting for something in Russian. Like those literal words mean I'm really looking forward to.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. And it's that song is really good. And if it wasn't really good, then it would feel like that ending was super tacked on just because you wanted to have this cool band in your film. It still feels slightly like that to the cynical side of me, but I think they get away with it.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. Before we wrap this thing up,
mm-hmm.
I have a question about accessibility.
Meaning? Smысле?
Possibly the wrong person to ask, because I'd have to ask somebody who watched the film who just didn't really know very much about Russia and like whether they got it or whether it made sense or whatever. But do you think...
I don't think I got it really fully.
No, I'm not saying I did either, but I felt like if I'd watched this before I went to Russia, even more of it would have just totally gone over my head. Like, they refer to Russian poets like Mayakovsky, who I'd certainly not heard of before I went to Russia. And it's not super important who that is, but it is kind of useful to, you know, because they just mention him as a name.
Mm-hmm.
So...
I mean, I'm getting to the point where, like, I started studying Russian in university when I was 18, and I'm getting to the point that that was basically half my life ago.
Not quite.
But, like, all of my adult life, essentially, I've either been studying Russian something or living in Russia. I don't think I can answer that question about whether or not it would be accessible if you didn't know anything about Yevgeny Onegin that Krimov starts reciting as a great example of why Pushkin is so great and all this other stuff. So I had trouble understanding, like I said, I had trouble understanding what was going on, and I kind of knew the cultural stuff, I knew the historical context, and it was a difficult movie. Like, I can see why it's considered to be good, but I can also see why it didn't travel well at all.
I think in saying that you couldn't answer the question, you kind of have, so... I guess we'd say...
You almost have to do a bit of research on the movie before you watch it. And by research, I mean more than just this podcast. Like, maybe Google it.
Yeah, look up the Wikipedia article or something.
Wikipedia is always totally accurate.
Well, sure. I'm just thinking of something that would be easy to find.
True. I mean, we haven't even talked about the title of the movie, Asa. Yeah. Like, I don't get why it's called that. So
they explain at the beginning, but I'd never heard that before.
I'd never heard that either. It's supposedly a biblical reference with Noah and the flood.
Yeah.
Immediately after the flood. But still, it's just, like, I don't get it, so.
Yeah. So, we both enjoyed it?
I don't know if I even enjoyed it.
It almost sounds like you've changed your opinion of it as we've been talking.
I mean, no, I there are movies that you can recognize that it's a good movie as far as the way it was done and the way it was acted and whatnot. And the music in it and everything. But you don't find it enjoyable and you wouldn't want to be like, yeah, I want to rewatch this because I just loved it so much. I think those are two different things.
Sure. I think I definitely want to rewatch this at some point. But I feel like I might revisit parts of it more often than I might watch it end to end. It's kind of a intriguing, like, I don't want to call it a mess because I think it's deliberately made the way that it is, but it does have a very loose feel to it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you wanted to, you could have that amount of plot in, you could take at least an hour out of the movie and it would still be the same plot. I think it would be a way more boring, run-of-the-mill movie for it. But, yeah, perhaps more accessible, but...
Dunno.
So I'm guessing I'm saying, it's a really interesting film.
Culturally important.
Oh, yeah, that's definitely... It's a big deal in Russia. Which is why it got selected for this season. And it looks great. And I like the atmosphere and the humour. I know you don't necessarily agree on the latter one particularly. But basically what I'm saying is, maybe check it out. But if you get to the end of it and just go, what was that? Don't hate us for it.
Uh-huh.
But there is one thing I think we should mention before we wrap it up. I meant to mention it earlier when we were talking about the performances, but we found out today the rather sad news that Stanislav Gavrukhin, who played Krimov, actually passed away today. So, yeah, that's kind of a weird coincidence, but yeah, that was super, super sad. But I'm glad I got to see this movie and enjoy his really fantastic performance as a really horrible person. So, yeah, it does make me want to check out other stuff that he's in. And I think he was a director as well. So, yeah, Stanislav Gavrukhin, a talented guy, clearly. Okay, so I think that's the end of the podcast now. Thank you very much, Carrie, for being a guest again.
And thank you for having me on and feeding me before we recorded so I wasn't hangry this time. Although, maybe I shouldn't have had a drink right before doing this.
Eh, whatever. Okay, thanks very much for listening, folks.
Thank you. До свидания.
До свидания. Yeah, you shouldn't have had a drink. Hello again. I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Russo Files Unite podcast. If you'd like to get in touch, I'd love to hear from you. So, there's a couple of different ways you can do that. There's a Russo Files Unite Facebook group you can join. We're on Twitter at RusFilesU, that's RusFiles with the letter U at the end. We're on Instagram at RusFiles_Unite. And you can also email at RusFilesUnite@gmail.com. Also, if you can spare a couple of minutes to rate us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts, that will help other people hear about the show and would be very much appreciated. Thanks again for listening and goodbye. На пылающий город падает тень. Перемен требуют наши сердца. Перемен требуют наши глаза. В нашем смехе и в наших слезах и пульсации.